one, a joint was thin. They were tiny. Pot was so illegal, I didn't want to know about it. Another night, I went down to the barn to see a band, and one of the guys rolled a joint in the bathroom, and he goes, "Hey, you want to smoke this?" "Nope," I said. "I don't need that. I got enough problems." Plus, I'd seen Reefer Madness, so I passed it up. But then, I got curious. I don't know if it was the smell or the romance, but eventually, everything that I did was illegal, immoral, or fattening. Shortly thereafter, I started growing pot, hiding it from the family, as if they would ever know what it was. I thought if I put it right there in the field, knowing my luck, someone would probably mow it down. So I went up to the power lines and planted some seeds, thinking that maybe I was far enough away. I figured I could just go up there and water the plants whenever necessary. But first off, I took a fish, a perch that I'd caught in a lake, chopped it up in little pieces, and put it on the stone wall so the summer heat would ferment it. After 2 weeks, flies are buzzing around it. It's rotten, just stinky. I mulched it with dirt, put it in the ground, took my pot seed, and went up and watered it every day. 2 months later, I have a freakish bonsai of a pot plant. It's had plenty of fertilizer, but for some reason it wasn't growing. The stems were hard like wood. What's wrong? I wondered. Maybe it was because New Hampshire's cold at night. That's it. Wrong. Turns out they'd sprayed DDT or some pesticide under the power lines that stunted the plant's growth. Hey, motherfuckers! I was pulling leaves off and smoking it and getting high anyway, but the plant only had 7 leaves on it. Still, I loved getting high and being in the woods. I would trip and go up to the mountains and streams with Debbie Benson. She was my dream fuck when I was 15. I'd get high smoking pot with my friends in my cabin. We'd lock the door, even though I never had to hide my pot smoking from my mom. I'd say, "Mom, you're drinking. Why don't you smoke pot instead?" I'd twist one up and say, "Ma, see what it smells like?" She never said, "Put that out." Mainly because Mom loved her 5 o'clock cocktail. Or the contact high. I used to hitchhike from Trorico down to the harbor, which is, what, 4 miles? When I had no car, I walked. In New Hampshire at night in the woods, it's so dark you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. All those terrifying stories I'd told to my friends back in the Bronx came to teeming life. Wolf packs, black widow spiders, silhouettes of the Boston Strangler, bloodthirsty Indians. I knew there weren't any Indian tribes left up at Sunapee. We, the white man, had wiped them out. But what about the ghosts of the Indians? They would be really pissed off, rabid with unquenchable bloodlust. Or else I was tripping on my mom's homemade hard cider. When clouds went over the moon, the road got pitch black, and I went, "Oh, shit." I tapped my way with a stick like Blind Pew from Treasure Island. Really lonely. And scary. Yonkers in the Bronx were always lit up. You could hide in the snowbanks, and when a car came around the corner, you could grab onto the bumper and ski along behind it. But in Sunapee, I almost had to crawl on my hands and knees to follow the white line down the middle of a dark country road. Later on, I'd be back on my hands and knees following another kind of white line down a different dark road. When I lived up there and September came and everybody was gone, I'd feel abandoned. Rough stuff when you're young. I used to think, am I going to be that crotchety old fuck yelling at kids to get off my lawn? Nah, that's not me. I was the kid pissing on the lawn. You know, at this point in my life, I'm still in the woods. There's still so much I'm not sure of, and I kind of like that. It's the fear that drives us. Seasons of Wither comes from the angst and loneliness of those nights when I was walking down that spooky road. Fireflies dance in the heat of hound dogs that bay at the moon. My ship leaves in the midnight. Can't say I'll be back too soon. They awaken far, far away. Heat of my candle, show me the way. Now something new entered my life. Less scary in one way, but in another, more terrifying since it involves girls. That was long before I figured women out. Right, Stephen, you never did figure them out, did you? Just became a rock star, and that sort of solved the problem. You think? Anyway, my cousin Augie and I had talked these two girls into going camping overnight with us. Two girls, a tent, day gives way to night, booze. Oh man, you never know what could happen with that scenario. We could get lucky, you never know. We came to a beautiful rolling hill. It looked so plush and soft at night. Wow, where are we? I don't know, man, but let's pitch the tent and, you know. We had a six-pack of beer, girls, what could be bad? I don't think we're doing the wild thing, but definitely making out and getting drunk. I wish I'd had the evil mind back then that I have now, but when you're a boy, you're mortally afraid of girls. Terrified. We wake up in the morning to someone shouting, "Four!" I will never forget that. We looked at each other. What does that mean? Four? Louder this time. Then a golf ball slams into the side of the tent. Oh, four! We'd pitched the tent on the third hole on the golf course. Naked and hungover, we grabbed our stuff and ran like hell. When I was 6 or 7, I went to church and sang hymns. There was a table with candles on it, and I thought God lived under that table. I thought that through the power of song, God was there. It was the energy rolling through those hymns. When I first heard rock and roll, what did it do to me? God. Before I had sex, it was sex. The first song that went directly into my bloodstream was All for the Love of a Girl. Way before the Beatles and the Brit Invasion, when I was 9 or 10, I got a little AM radio. But at night up in Sunapee, the wind howled and I couldn't get the radio stations I wanted, so I ran a wire up to the top of the apple tree. It's still there. And I picked up WOWO out of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and heard All for the Love of a Girl. It was the B-side of Johnny Horton's Battle of New Orleans. All for the Love of a Girl was a slow pick-and-strum love song with Johnny Horton curling his lips around the lyrics, twanging each word as if it were a guitar string. It was very basic, almost the archetypal love song. It's kind of an every love song ever written ballad. It's all there in four lines. Bliss, heartbreak, loneliness, despair. I sat in the apple tree and lived every line of it. The only thing missing was my raging schooner, the likes of which you could pup a tent with. When I heard the Everly Brothers, I Wonder If I Care As Much, and those double harmonies, I lost my breath. No one ever did that anguished teen love song better than the Everly Brothers. Kathy's Clown, Let It Be Me, So Sad to Watch Good Love Go Bad, When Will I Be Loved? Oh, man, those heart-rending Appalachian harmonies. Those harmonic fifths. I mean, God lives in the fifths. And anyone who can sing harmonies like that, that's as close to God as we're going to get short of a mother giving birth. Behold the act of creation, divine and perfect. If you have any doubts, try this. Take a deep breath and hold one note with somebody, a friend, your main squeeze, your parole officer. When two people hold the same note and one person goes slightly off that note, you'll hear an eerie vibration. It's an unearthly sound. I think in those vibrations, there exist very strong healing powers, not unlike the mysterious stuff the ancient shamans understood and used. Now sing in fifths. One sing a C and the other a G. Then one of you goes off key. That's dissonance. Fifths, in musical terms, are first cousins, and in those fifths, there's a magical throb. If you close your eyes and you touch foreheads, you'll feel a wild interplanetary vibration. It's a little-known secret, but that's how piano tuners tune a Steinway. God and sound and sex and the electric world grid, it's all connected. It's pumping through your bloodstream. God is in the gaps between the synapses. Vibrating, pullulating, pulsating. That's eternity, baby. The whole planet is singing its weird cosmic dirge. The rotation of the earth resonates a great, terrible rumbling, grumbling G-flat. You can actually hear the earth groan like howling wolf. DNA and RNA chains have a specific resonance corresponding exactly to an octave tone of the Earth's rotation. It all really is cosmic, man. Music of the fucking spheres. The third rock from the sun is one big megasonic piezoelectric circuit, humming, buzzing, drizzling with freak noise and harmony. The Earth's upper atmosphere is wailing for its baby in ear-piercing screeches, chirps, and whistles, where charged particles from the solar wind, the sun's psychic pellets, collide with Mother Earth's magnetic field. Earth blues. Maybe some shortwave surfing extraterrestrial out there listening through his antenna will hear our cosmic moan. You can just about guess that anything can is gonna happen, so long as we stay here on Earth. In a Stratocaster, say, you use a pickup wrapped with a few thousand coils of copper wire to amplify the sound of the strings. The vibration of the nearby strings modulates the magnetic flux, and the signal is fed into an amplifier, which intensifies that frequency and blasts out into the arena. In the same way that you can take a note and amplify it, you could amplify the whole fucking planet. Planet waves. Take a compass. It's just a needle floating on the surface of oil that's not allowed to float freely. The power holding that needle is magnetism. The needle is quivering, picking up the slightest frequencies. Now, if you could amplify that, in 30 years you're going to be able to do that, and I'll have been sitting here going, you know, there's power in the needle of a compass, and it's actually a magnetic grid, the Earth. So if you could amplify the magnetic frequencies of a guitar string, you could certainly amplify the magnetic frequencies of Earth and beam it out there. Then you'd have the galactic blues blasted and stratocasted out to the farthest planet in the cosmos. Right outside my house in Sunapee, there's a big rock that my kids used to call Sally. It was their favorite thing to climb because it was big and menacing and it drew them in. I had a special mystic boulder too, but I never named my rock. It was right behind Papa's cabin. It's probably 30 feet around and 7 feet high. Its surface so slick and smooth you can't get a grip to climb it. But next to this rock was a tree. And using the tree, I leveraged myself up and onto the top of the rock. I thought, if I can get on this rock and stand where no other human has ever stood, I can communicate with aliens. This raised some eyebrows among the other 8-year-olds on the playground. When I scaled the boulder, my first thought was, holy shit, I'm on top of the world. This is my rock. Then I ran down to the basement of Trorico, grabbed the fucking chisel, an inch round, 6 inches long, got a big ball peen hammer, a really fat one that we used for chipping away stone to make stone walls, and I carved ST into that rock. So when the aliens come, and someday they are going to come, they'll see my marking and know that I was here and needed to make contact, and that I was one of the humans who wanted to live forever. That was my kid thought. I visited that rock recently, wet my finger, and rubbed it on the place where I'd carved my initials, and they were still there. I took some cigarette ash and put it in the S so I could take a photograph of it. E.T., meet S.T. That was my childhood. I read too much. I fantasized too much. I lived in the what if. When I read Khalil Gibran, I recognized the same alien shiver of wildness. And forget not that the earth delights to feel your bare feet and the winds long to play with your hair. Trorico went the way of my childhood. Lost and gone forever, my darling Clementine. It stopped being a summer resort somewhere around 1985. You can't go home again. You go back and it's not the same. It's all crazy, small. Gives you vertigo trying to go back. Like if you went to visit your mom, walked into the kitchen and she had a different face. Chapter 2. Zits and Tits. 2 months before my 8th birthday, Elvis, Heartbreak Hotel, Hound Dog. It was like getting bitten by a radioactive spider. Elvis, the extraterrestrial. But it wasn't Elvis who first turned me on to rock and roll. I was too young to quite get it. But 4 years later, Chubby Checker and Dima, the incredible diving horse, came roaring into my life. By the time I was 12, Chubby Checker's Twist was huge. It was the only single to top Billboard's Hot 100 twice. I went with my family in the summer of 1960 and saw him at the Steel Pier in New Jersey. It was such a big fucking hit, even your parents wanted to see him. He was playing live that night. And I got to see a woman on a horse jump off a 30-foot diving platform into a tank of water. The announcer said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Dima the Wonder Horse is going to dive into this small tank of water. Her rider, Miss Olive Gelnaw, will guide Dima during her 30-foot drop into the tank. Now we need you to be very quiet. It takes all of her concentration to get it right, or they will miss the tank and fall to their death." Dima and her rider made a perfect dive and landed in the tank. Most of the water flew up in a huge wave over the side of the tank, and the crowd went wild. And those two images, Chubby Checker doing the twist and the sexy girl in a bathing suit on a huge horse in a death-defying leap, fused in my mind. And that was my introduction to the world of rock and roll. I heard sex in Twist. I didn't know what sex was. I hadn't gotten laid yet. I didn't know how to do sex. I didn't know what blowjobs were. And I'm supposed to put my thing in your what? But I heard sex in the music. And that's what I loved. I loved that someone could allude to the most primal of instincts, what everybody wanted to do on a date, and put it in a song on the radio. And if the song came on and you were with your date, you ended up doing it. Wow. And then there was the fuck all of it. All the things you couldn't say or do, you could do on stage or in your music.
What about that Ian Whitcomb song, where he sings like a girl and he's begging a girl?
By singing it in that crazy falsetto voice, he was able to convey unspeakable emotions that made girls blush and turned heads everywhere. And he nailed it. It was a huge hit. And they all had the same things in common. Little Richard's high falsetto screams that incited the Beatles' high harmonies. And then there was the end of Ian Whitcomb's Turn On song, which spoke to those who heard it like a breathy wet spot that climbed right out of the speakers and grabbed you by the neck and made your ears cry. And there was nothing you could do about it except dance or be the lead singer of a band and do it all yourself. And then, later on, I went and saw Janis Joplin. Now, that really was my world, pure emotion. On stage, she played the role of that gin-soaked ballroom queen. With her gravelly delta voice and street smarts she could have only gotten by going through all these experiences herself, she transcended all those who came before her. The way she sang a song, it seemed like she'd been down that road one too many times, and it wasn't going to happen again, not this time around. She had a brand new kind of kick-ass confidence, laced with a super hippie, smart-ass, kinky kind of sassafrassy strut to her vocals, the likes of which you'd never heard before. After seeing Janis, it almost seemed like you'd come from a raise the tent, raise your spirit, Pentecostal, holy roller revelation type thing. It was that kind of mind-altering sound, and it was like, oh my God. It was such a raunchy matter-of-factness, a drug-induced sexy animal rush to the way she belted out Piece of My Heart. I mean, that was the shit. It was almost as if she gave her heart away 1,000 times and never did quite get it back. Janis up there, Janis, what a grand dame, like someone's mom, but a cross between a stately old woman and a loud, brassy New Orleans bordello whore. That was the end of the 60s. That's what Janis was to me, a revolutionary spirit, someone who changed emotional weather. Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Eddie Cochran, Little Richard, Roll Over Beethoven, Who Do You Love, A Wop Bop A Loo Wop A Bop Bam Boom, pure adrenaline rush. I'd been zapped by an alien tractor beam and it was pulling me toward the mothership. The Beach Boys. In my room, oh my God. All I can tell you is that my girlfriend got turned on just now hearing me say those words with such ecstatic glee. That song was the first time I got up from behind the drums and grabbed the microphone away from my bass player and said, "You know what? I'm singing that fucking song, pal." And then, abracadabra, I became a singer. I bought a gooseneck and put the microphone on it. Ladies and genitals, give it up for Steven Tallarico on vocals. But I'm getting ahead of my story. By the time I was 15, I knew what I wanted to do, aside from getting high and trying to get into girls' pants under the aqueduct. Drums. A friend's big brother had a drum set in the basement. We snuck down there, and when I saw that set of drums, I was infatuated. I couldn't believe that something you banged on made that much noise, and it wasn't pots and pans. I sat down behind the snare drum, and that was the beginning of the end. I bought instruction records by Sandy Nelson, who introduced the drum solo into pop singles in the late 50s. His big hit was Let There Be Drums in 61. He would play these cool beats at the end, just on a snare. It sounded like 10 snares doing a marching beat. That's funk and soul right there. Fucking everything. There was my card. I just landed on that fucking place in the great game of life. My pass go card, my get out of jail free card. That was the magic. That's the funk the blacks knew. That's the soul that Elvis knew, right there. Now I had the key to it all, especially after attending the Westchester Workshop Drums Unlimited. I went to lessons at the WWDU. A guy gave me a rubber thing with heavy sticks, and I learned my rudiments. Paradiddles and stuff. I listened to those Sandy Nelson records like the Beatles LPs when they came out. My head practically inside the speaker, hanging on every movement, every nuance of soundage, even the psychoacoustics, reveling in it. But at the end of one album, Sandy had this thing, like a cross between a 007 guitar and surf rock. Adventures slash Dick Dale rat-a-tat-tat, basically with accents. It's all accents. He took the drum beat, but gave it a twist, and that one thing was the turning point. The way he reversed the beat through the accents, I fucking lost it. I gotta know that, screamed the mouth within. So like I said before, I got under the hood and learned it. The first time I got up on stage to play was at the barn. It must have been the summer of 1963. A group called the Maniacs were playing, and when they'd finished their set, they let me up on stage. I'd like to introduce Steven Tallarico. I played the classic drum solo on Wipeout. It was just a speeded-up version of a riff from a high school marching band beat, but it sounded stratospheric, a pure sex, drugs, and rock and roll rush. All right, now I knew. I was making a huge racket with this Demolition Derby-driven surfer blast. Everybody loved it. I loved it. John Conrad, the guy who ran the barn, was beaming. I was in the zone. When I think about it now, 49 years later, I still have the same rush of feeling, that same energy and joy of the endorphins flooding my brain. It's close to an addiction. I close my eyes and I just want to do it. To play that set and sing those songs. Those songs were my way out. I got into street fights in the Bronx all the time. An hour and a half they went on. I'd come home bloody as hell. I was made fun of quite a lot at high school. Jewish kids were constantly picked on. They got to see a side of life the other half doesn't see. Prejudice. I got spit on in school and called nigger lips. The kids would snap my earlobes with their fingers, which was especially painful on freezing cold days. Being hassled at the bus stop, however, turned out to be my salvation. Initially, I might have been offended, but as soon as I learned how to sing, I was right proud of that moniker because I then realized that those were my roots. My black roots were in black music, and it was nothing to be ashamed of. My family history, if you go back 200 years ago, the Tallaricos were from the boot of Italy, Calabria. And before that, Albanians, Egyptians, Ethiopians. But let's face it, in the end, in the beginning, actually, we're all Africans. You can't grow humans in cold weather. And before we were humans, we were apes. And if we can't take the cold weather, how could a monkey who doesn't even know how to buy a coat? So if you go back, you're black. It's so stupid to go around saying, I'm Italian, the way I do all the time. My way of avoiding being beaten up at school was to play the drums in a band. My first group was the Strangers, Don Solomon, Peter Stahl, and Alan Stonemeyer. Peter played guitar, Alan bass, Don was the lead singer, and I played drums. We would set up in the cafeteria and do a mixer after school. I played Wipeout and sang in my room.
In high school, the key to not being made fun of is to be entertaining. The same way that some fat people become funny, tell jokes, make fun of people, and then they get left alone. I was skinny and big-lipped and pinheaded. I grew my hair and played the drums in a band, and that was my key to acceptance. I knew about music from my dad, and so rock and roll was a case of please don't throw me in the briar patch. I was giddily starstruck. At the Brooklyn Fox, I ran up on stage and touched Mary Weiss, the lead singer of the bad girl group The Shangri-Las. With her long blonde hair, black leather pants, and melancholy eyes, Mary Weiss was a teen goddess. She alone was reason enough for making rock and roll your own personal religion, especially while she was singing Leader of the Pack. She was a gorgeous, tough girl who later got questioned by the FBI for carrying a gun across state lines. I was completely smitten with her. The next time I saw her, it was a little more intimate, but not because Mary Weiss wanted it that way. In 1966, I went to Cleveland with one of my later bands, Chain Reaction, to do this teen dance show, Upbeat. I wanted to sing leads, so I got David Conrad, nephew of John Conrad, who ran the barn, to play drums. There were no dressing rooms, so I went into the bathroom to change. I heard someone in the next stall. Thinking it was David, as a joke, I hoisted myself up to the top of the stall. But when I peered over, there was Mary Weiss, with her black leather pants around her ankles and her patch showing. I got such the boner from that. I fantasized about that for weeks. It got me through a lot of cold winter nights up in Sunapee. At our house in Yonkers, no one locked their doors. So with the advent of sex and drugs, I had to figure something out to stop anyone from catching me smoking pot or rubbing one out or whatever else I was doing up there. A serious problem for a teenager. You had to put a chair in front of the door, but what a drag. From working with traps, I knew how to rig things, and I came up with an ingenious way of locking a door. I drilled through the tongue, the metal latch that goes into the strike plate of the door, and put a coat hanger through it, leaving 4 inches sticking out like a pin on a hand grenade. If you turn the handle, the door wouldn't open. Then I devised a more fiendish plan. Through the mail, I bought an induction coil, which is nothing more than a transformer for an electric train. On your train set, you can turn the transformer up to 10, 20, 30, 40, so your Lionel train is just whipping around the track until it's going so fast it falls off the tracks. I took the induction coil and attached it to the railing on the way up to my room so that if anyone touched that railing, they'd be zapped right off their feet. I'd be upstairs doing a girl. Parents were gone for the weekend, those few chosen moments when I needed serious warning. And yes, people did get zapped, but only my best friends. I'd go, touch that, and they'd go, yow! Suddenly, best friends were so well behaved. I don't know what happened. Once I ran a wire all the way down to the basement and up under the couch and the pillows, I undid the wires, stripped about 4 inches off the insulation, spread them out, the positive and negative wires, and put them under the cushion so that whoever sat on the couch would get zapped. My best friend was down there eating peanuts. Here, have this beer, I said. I'll be right back. I'm upstairs in my room, turning the train transformer on, and I get the door open and I switch it on. I'd hear the transformer buzz as it connected. I'm waiting there, listening to hear what happens. Yow! Just a little evil teenage fun. When the House of the Rising Sun came on the radio, I thought it was the greatest record I'd ever heard. I saw the Animals perform it at the Academy of Music and was so overcome with raw emotion, I jumped out of my seat, ran up the aisle, and shook the bass player Chaz Chandler's hand. Then came the Stones. Rock is my religion, and these guys were my gods. You don't need to go to the fucking Temple of Doom to find my banter on the Stones or the Yardbirds, what I thought about back then in my 16-year-old make-believe mind. It would have been the desire to write a song or be in an English band when the first Brit invasion came over, and more than anything, fame. Immortality. I wanted to inject myself into the grooves of the record. I wanted dreamy, nubile girls to listen to my voice and cry. 1,000 years after my death, I fantasized that there'd be people in the outer galaxies listening to Dream On and saying in hushed tones, It's him, the strange immortal one. And then briefly, I was touched by the caressing hand of fate when, sometime in 1964, I became Mick Jagger's brother, Chris. Mick Jagger was the baddest guy on the block, and of course, I empathetically picked up on all his shit. Mick and Keith and all that, it hit me like a locomotive. It's All Over Now was like a fucking blues freight train coming straight at me. In the summer of 64, I went to a lake in upstate New York, Bashbish Falls or something like that, up near Utica, with a bunch of kids from Yonkers. Long hair, 16, no band, but somebody said, "Wow, you look like Mick Jagger." And that was it. Off and running. You know what? I'm Chris, Mick Jagger's brother. I am him. And I went with it like mad. Shot off from there to this limey planet and immediately lapsed into a Cockney accent. I was talking like, "Bloody bleating, poncy wanker, spot of marmite, darling. Care for a leaper, mate? Ghastly weather we're having, innit?" It's called, you know, lost days of youth. When you're a kid, you can jump into other people's personalities like a transmute. I can still relate to that. In those days of the British invasion, you had to be a Brit to make it. First of all, you had to have a bloody English accent. That was number one. And that I could do. I still have those Strangers clippings at home. Steven Tyler, his lower lip hanging like Jagger's, brought the front row to its feet. They wrote that in the paper. Bought my Mick impersonation, lock, stock, and barrel. I couldn't believe it. But of course, I, more than anyone else on the planet, believed it. I was him. I was barely 16, but in my mind, already one of England's greatest hit makers. Even if the Strangers sounded more like a bad imitation of Freddie and the Dreamers than the Stones, Yonkers' greatest hit makers, maybe. In the early 70s, I was embarrassed to say I was into Mick because the press was already harping on the Mick Jagger and Steven Tyler thing, and I wanted to get as far away as possible from those comparisons. I was hoping they would find something in my music that would have some merit other than making Aerosmith into some sort of tribute band with me as a mock Mick Jagger. But yes, he was my fucking hero. There's actually a 6 or 7 year period where I was afraid to tell the press that. I was like, "No, he isn't." And then, of course, I came out of the closet and went, "Fucking A, he is." To this day, to this minute, to this second, Mick Jagger is still my hero. I remember being at a club at One Central Square in the West Village in early 66, turning around and seeing Mick Jagger and Brian Jones sitting behind me. Not a word came out of my mouth. I didn't become Steven Tyler all at once. I made him up, bit by bit. He kind of grew out of playing all the clubs in New York and doing acid and hanging out in Greenwich Village and tripping and going to Bean's and Central Park. All that stuff is where I come from. But more than anything, I was shaped by the kind of music that I listened to in 64, 65, 66. The Yardbirds, the Stones, the Animals, the Pretty Things, and their wild drummer, Viv Prince. He was Keith Moon before Keith Moon became the maniacal drummer of The Who. Moon used to go down to the Marquee Club to watch him and pick up a few mad moves. And of course, the Beatles, whom I saw at Shea Stadium. They were the musical G-spot. I'd get all the Brit imports from a record store down in the IRT subway station at 46th Street. Those Yardbirds 45s, For Your Love, Shapes of Things, Over Under Sideways Down. That's what I cut my teeth on, not that I was in any shape in 1964 to take all that stuff and run with it. I'd take Speed and listen to the Yardbirds, the Pretty Things, the Stones. We were, what, 16? You couldn't drink till you were 18, so all we could do was grass and pills. Red crosses, white crosses, Christmas trees, Dexedrin, Benzedrine. I'd go up to Sunapee in the winter and sit in the barn, 4 feet of snow outside, light a fire, and snort Speed until I was vibrating at the same frequency as the fucking records. The Strangers slowly began to get gigs. We played a lot of weird places at the beginning, like Banana Fish Park on Long Island. We even had the slogan, "The Strangers, English sounds, American R&B. At Easter, my mom drove the Strangers up to Sunapee to perform. We played stuff like She's a Woman and the Dave Clark Five's Bits and Pieces. My motto has always been, fake it till you make it. If you want to be a rock and roll star, like Keith Richards says, you got to get your moves off in the mirror first. The look. Pick up a copy of Rave magazine, see what the cool cats are wearing in swinging London this month. Rave was the mid-60s Brit mag of the immaculate mod haberdashery. Check out Mick's houndstooth pants and green shoes. Where'd Keith Ralph get those wraparound shades, man? You gotta stay on top of this stuff, you know, if you wanna be a rock star. Gotta be properly attired in the latest mod gear when the moment arises and the fickle finger of Billboard's top 10 touches you. I scoured the pseudo Carnaby Street's boutiques of Greenwich Village for the genuine article. Collarless shirts, leather vests, and checkered pants at Paul Sargent's on 8th Street. Beetle boots with Cuban heels from Bloom's Shoe Gallery in the West Village, or Florsheim shoes on 42nd Street. They had the fucking greatest boots, high heels, tight around the ankles. Those were the ones I wore on stage. Then there were the mod shoes, brightly colored Capizio ballet shoes, flowered shirts, and satin scarves. Well, okay, the scarves came later, inspired by Janis Joplin. Those I got along with my incense from Sindori. Is that what the place was called? An import store across the street from the Fillmore East. In the early days, I would put incense all over the amps and in front of the stage to mark my territory. I thought by burning exotic scents like myrrh, they'd remember me by my smell, like God in their church. I wanted something other than our bad tuning and my ugly fucking Mick Jagger face to remember us by. It's like if I were a dog, I would go out to the tip of the stage, lift my leg, pee, and say, I'd like to leave a little something for you to remember me by. Dogs piss on trees to mark their territory, so I marked mine with incense and banners, like old Scottish tartans that I found, the ones that held special family colors and crests. It's so funny, the obsessive limey mimicking that went on. Back in 1966, down on Delancey Street, where the blacks got their stuff, you could get a beautiful leather jacket for $26. But who had $26 back then? I'd hang around Bloom's Shoe Gallery just waiting to see who would go in. I bought all my shit there, you know, because they did. The Stones, Birds, Dylan. Mike Clark, the drummer for the Birds, turned me on to this place in Estes Park, Colorado, where he got his moccasins, the ones he wore on an album cover. I asked him, how could I get a pair of those? He gave me the address and I got me a pair, which I later on brought into the studio where we were recording our first album. I got the rubber stamp holder with all the different rubber stamps they used to mark the 2-inch master reels. The rubber stamps would say Dolby Outtakes, Remix Version, Slave, Master, all things that could be done to tapes. I rubber stamped my moccasins, which I chose to call my recording boots, all over, and I wore them till the soles fell off. Bloom's Shoe Gallery was where I ran into Bob Dylan. Okay, he was coming out of there and I was walking in. I'd love to have a great story where I told him I was in a band. I wasn't. I wish I could have told him I loved his voice. I did. I used to go down and walk around Greenwich Village all the time, hoping to bump into the Stones, which, of course, never happened. I never got a chance to speak to Dylan or Keith or Mick to ask them how the fuck they wrote their songs. I assumed they had to get their lyrics from their life experiences. I knew that drugs had something to do with it. I'd heard that Pete Townsend's stutter in My Generation came from Leapers, some weird-ass British speed. Tuinols, acid, and grass. I knew about those. And there was this drug called coke. I had been around the block, and I'd done as much crank as anyone. But somewhere along the line, I decided to do something else instead of using the speed to go and party in the village. Fuck that. I think I'll stay at home tonight and channel John Lennon. I'll write a song based on my muddled understandings and my profound misunderstandings that'll change the world. But it took a while to get to that place. New York City was filled with very odd folk, which I loved. I'd take my mother's car down to the city, park it on the street, get a parking ticket, throw it away, and drive home. I can't imagine how many tickets I got. I know I never paid any of them. A rock and roll Dillinger in the making. Or I'd leave the car in the Bronx at the first train stop, which was past White Plains and Yonkers Raceway, get on the train, and get off at 59th Street, Columbus Circle. The 59th Street subway stop wasn't that far from where Moondog would stand with his spear and Viking helmet. He lived on the street, wore only homemade clothes, and thought of himself as the incarnation of the Norse god Thor. He was so noble and mysterious, like a character from mythology come to life on Sixth Avenue. Moondog wrote All His Loneliness, that Janis sang on Big Brother and the Holding Company's first album. He'd hang out with a bald-headed guy who would blow raspberries and yell, "Fuck you!" at anyone who walked by. He had a ragged and gravelly street voice. Welcome to Freak City. There were freaks on the streets, in the clubs, on TV. There were magnificent misfits everywhere, and you had no idea what they were famous for, but they were all famous for something. I love them. Then I'd wander into Central Park, smoke weed, and catch a sweet Gotham buzz. On Friday afternoons, me, Ray Tabano, Debbie Benson, Ricky Holtzman's girlfriend, and Debbie's friend Dia would head for Greenwich Village because that's where the beatniks lived, and we wanted to be beatniks. It was the summer of 64. I was a white boy from Yonkers, trying to get high, trying to get hip. We'd sit in Washington Square Park drinking Southern Comfort or Seagram 7 or whatever else we could mooch off somebody until we were completely shit-faced on booze, pills, and pot. Then we'd go check out the clubs, the Kettle of Fish, the Tin Angel, the Bitter End, the Night Owl, Trudy Heller's Café Wa. Those clubs in New York were my education. Later on, we played all those joints. The smell of those bars was like a funky, nostalgic patchouli. To this day, I love the stale smell of cigarettes and beer that you got in those places. One night, we were wandering around the village and saw a group advertising itself as the Strangers outside a club. They seemed to be a pretty established band and sounded better than us, so, adding a U, we decided to change our name to the mildly pretentious Strangers. I'd go down there Friday night, come home Sunday. I loved it. I wanted that life so bad. I'd sit on a car in the West Village outside the Tin Angel with Zal Yanovsky from the Lovin' Spoonful and talk. He wore culottes, a Bleecker Street Keith Richards, and Josie the She-Demon, a transvestite who paraded around Greenwich Village with no particular mission save her own sense of eccentric expression. It was just such a trip. Then uptown there was Ondine's and Steve Paul's club, The Scene. Teddy Slattis was the doorman at The Scene, a runty little guy. You'd go down the stairs into a cellar. It was like the beatnik grottos from old movies. Low ceiling, small, cramped, but magical. Everybody looked like Andy Warhol. Steve Paul in his turtleneck, tall, talking in a beat lingo so fast and clipped you could barely grasp what he was saying. But you knew it was hip, and one day you'd be able to understand it. Late at night, Jimi Hendrix, Paul McCartney, or Brian Jones would just show up and play. They'd be on a tiny stage about 4 feet away from you. I performed there early in 68 with my second band, William Proud, with Tiny Tim singing and playing Tiptoe Through the Tulips on his ukulele, a tall, skinny Lebanese freak with long, greasy hair, a high voice, and bad teeth. But that was the great thing about The Scene. He wasn't treated like a sideshow character. It was more like, this is the artist in residence. He belongs. You've got to get in tune with him if you want to fit in. I would go see bands like The Doors at The Scene, and I couldn't believe the way the lead singer was acting. I thought, wow, what the fuck? But maybe that's the reason people love The Doors, because they really thought Jim Morrison was possessed. That club was seriously in your face. I can't tell you how close you were to the performers. You sat at a little table, and right there was the Lizard King 3 feet away from you. I was Steve Talley, copying everything I saw, reading the poetry that Dylan was reading, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Gregory Corso. There were readings at the Kettle of Fish where Dylan would show up and recite his incredible shit. I'd sit there, slack-jawed and hypnotized. In 65, the Stones had two monster hits, Satisfaction and Get Off of My Cloud. We heard that they were staying at the Lincoln Square Motor Inn, so we got our friend Henry Smith to drive us down there in his mother's car with the excuse that we needed to go rehearse. I already had my mock Mick look down, and we got our bass player, Alan Stonemeyer, who had blonde bangs like Brian Jones, to come with us. When we got there, the streets around the hotel were mobbed with kids. Very cute, very hot girls, Stones fans. Well, how could I resist trying out my Mick impersonation on this crowd? I leaned out the window and in a very loud, crude Cockney accent said,
I say, I see some smashing crumpet out there, mates. What you doing later then, darling?
They went wild.
Mick! Mick! Brian, I love you!
Tears streaming down their faces. Lovely, except that they wrecked Henry's mother's car, tore off the radio antenna and the windshield wipers. It turned into a big riot and got on TV on the evening news. When we got back, Henry's mother was standing there with her arms crossed. Have a good rehearsal, boys? Because we were too young to drink at clubs in the city, I took two and alls and second alls. I'd crush all that shit up and snort it. I was always fucked up when we got into Manhattan. That same night we were at the scene, we saw Monty Rock III. We all knew about him from watching the Johnny Carson show on TV. On would come this very grand queen with a Let's Tell It Like It Is name. He was high camp, a flamboyantly gay hairdresser slash rocker or something. You didn't know what he did exactly. He was this outrageous person saying outrageous stuff. Who cared what he did? He wore pseudo-mod clothes, and in person he was just as over the top as he was on TV. Come on back to my house, darlings, he said. I really got some shit going on there. We get to his place, and there's two Great Danes, a chimpanzee and a defanged cobra, but it still bit you. Oh, and never mind the fucking freak folks that were there. Here we are, pubescent punks coming down from Yonkers. We hadn't a clue. Debbie Benson was gorgeous. We were cute kids. And here we were among these flaming queens. Someone starts passing around handfuls of Placidils. Here, have some of these. They were fucking paralytic downers, sleeping pills. Monty had a hot tub in his living room. I ended up knocking the plug out of his tub. After the water drained out, I threw some pillows in and slept there. Jim will be here soon, Monty said. Jim fucking Morrison was coming over? We all waited his arrival like that of a god. He came late, and by the time he got there, we were so wasted we thought it was Van Morrison. We were in some place where words melted into sounds, and Jim was out there. Even further. It scared the shit out of us. We were so terrified, we hid in the bedroom, then wound up getting under the sheets with a candle, just shaking because we were so fucking stoned. It was all so freaky. We were scared what the chimpanzee might do to the Great Danes, let alone what Monty had in mind for Morrison. We were in no shape to walk or talk. We took more Placidils and fell out around 2 a.m, totally zonked. Around 5 a.m., we woke up. Debbie was crying.
These aren't my clothes, she said.
What do you mean? I said. You're wearing the same dress you had on last night. Her eyes were glassy.
But these aren't my panties.
Oh, my God. I looked down and thought, what the fuck?
You know what? These aren't my pants either.
We were running down the stairs, Debbie crying,
I've been violated! I've been violated!
Shit, we'd all wanted to take a walk on the wild side, but this was a little bit more than we bargained for. The thing about the British invasion bands is that they were like gangs, especially the Rolling Stones and the Who. Unlike the Beatles, they looked defiant and menacing, guys you wouldn't mess with. I'd like to attribute this insight about groups and gangs to the Stones with their collective leathery eyeball, but I'd already figured this out long before the Beatles arrived, when the gang I was in turned into my first band. How do you get into a gang? You act tough, and I've always been good at the acting part anyway. I wasn't tough. I was skinny and scrawny and into my own weird world. Acting tough is easy. You just try and be as obnoxious as you can and get the shit beaten out of you for it. Throw in a few stupid and illegal things, like running across Central Avenue naked, stealing stuff for the clubhouse, and if they're feeling kindly, they'll let you in. At Roosevelt, there was this guy, Ray Tabano, who was to become my lifelong friend. We first became friends from my telling him to get the fuck out of my tree, the one he was climbing. Stay off my vines, I yelled. I paid for that a couple of days later when he beat the shit out of me, but it was worth it because I eventually became a member of a gang. really more of a club, called the Green Mountain Boys. With membership in a gang, you got protection from the more thuggish elements in high school. It also attracted girls, who are always into that kind of asshole. When I was about 14, I hung out with Ray at his dad's bar on Morris Park Avenue in the Bronx. Not bad for a hangout. He would let us drink beer. A local Bronx R&B group, the Bell Notes, used to perform there, and between their sets, Ray and I would sing their 1959 hit, I've Had It. We'd also do the old Lead Belly song, Cotton Fields, but in the collegiate folk song style of the Highwaymen, who had a hit with it in 1962. Later, I would be in a band called the Dantes with Ray that evolved out of the Green Mountain Boys, while still playing with the Strangers. The Strangers were more Beatle-ish in pop, the Dantes darker and stonesier. I played one gig with the Dantes. How the Strangers got their first manager and how I became the lead singer of the group also came out of the gang in a way, through Ray and stolen merchandise. I'd been ripping off stuff from the little Jewish corner candy store where I worked as a soda jerk in Yonkers. I'd go down in the basement where I did inventory and grab candy bars and packets of cigarettes and give them to Ray to sell. I then progressed to the Shopwell supermarket on Central Avenue. Bigger items, boxes, and crates. Peter Agosto was the store manager, and to prevent me from moving stuff out of the back of the store and handing it to Ray, he had me collect the shopping carts so he could have me where he could keep an eye on me. Why he didn't just fire me, I'll never know. I told him I was in a band, and he said he'd like to see us play, so I said I'd invite him to the next gig we played, which turned out to be a Sweet 16 party for Art Carney's daughter. It was a gig my dad had gotten us. He taught piano to Carney's son. Peter Agosto liked the group, but he thought I should be the lead singer. Oh, yeah. We got Barry Shapiro to play drums. This was the era of spacey rock. The Byrds' truly cosmic single, 8 Miles High, came out in March 1966. It vibrated in your brain like you were tripping. It was blacklisted by radio stations because it was thought to be a drug song. Duh. Despite Jim McGuinn's unconvincing explanations that it wasn't. I'll tell you what 8 Miles High was. A stratospheric Rickenbacker symphony. Soon Ray Tabano and I moved on to other quasi-criminal activities. To support our pot-smoking habit, we began selling nickel bags. Buy an ounce for $20, sell four, keep two for ourselves. This was a cool deal and a cheap way of getting high until they put an undercover narc, who will remain nameless, in our high school ceramics class. The fucking ceramics class. He popped us eventually, but first, he was selling us nickel bags of good shit he got off some other poor fuck he popped. On June 11th, 1966, Henry Smith booked us to play at an ice skating rink in Westport, Connecticut. We rehearsed that afternoon, did a sound check. I hoped some people in town would come because we had a little following in Connecticut. I'd met Henry Smith, the living myth, up in Sunapee in the summer of 1965. He became a close friend and a key person in my life. He was impressed with our sound when we played the barn, where we did stuff by the Stones, like Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, The Kinks, You Really Got Me, The Byrds version of Mr. Tambourine Man, and all the current hits. Slam dunk rockers like Louie Louie and Money. Henry and his brother Chris, the band's first photographer, started getting us gigs in Connecticut. Outside the rink, on the other side of the fence, was a trampoline center. I had been on the junior Olympic team in high school for trampoline. I could do 26 backflips in a row. Not such great form, but I could get height from hell. For $3, you could jump in this trampoline park for half an hour. There was nobody there, and I looked around and snuck over the fence. I jumped from one trampoline to another and on to the next one. Backflip. I'd probably got through the first 6 trampolines and onto the next row when I heard, "Hey, get the fuck off my trampolines." "Listen, man," I said, "we're playing next door. You want tickets?" His name was Scotty. "Oh, you're in the band that's playing here tonight?" He loved that. "Why don't you come up to my house?" I went over to Scotty's house. Nice pool and a fridge full of St. Pauli Girl. We're swimming and throwing back a few beers when these two guys come ripping into the driveway on the two sickest go-karts from hell. It's Paul Newman and our man Flint, James Coburn. Holy shit.
Scotty, what's going on?
I asked. Oh, that's my dad, he said.
Which one?
Paul Newman, he said. I'm Scotty Newman. Pleased to meet you.
You fucker. When were you going to tell me?
Paul Newman was very laid back and his cool, it's cool hand, Luke. It was like being in a movie with him. I went into the sauna with Paul and Scotty. We're all sitting in there getting sweaty, and Paul Newman whips out this bottle of 50-year-old brandy he'd got from the Queen of England, which I downed immediately. I toweled off, put my clothes back on, and wandered into the house. There on the mantelpiece was Joanne Woodward's Oscar with its arms folded, as all Oscars are. "Where's yours?" I asked Mr. Newman. "Well, I never got one, but my friend made that one up for me." It was a mock Oscar, only with its arms open wide instead of folded and with a guy going, "What?" Like, how could you have passed me up after all my great performances? 20 minutes later, I got a phone call from my mom, completely hysterical.
"They found it!" she's yelling.
"Mom, calm down," I said. "What's going on?" She starts explaining, and it ain't good. "The cops are here, and they found your marijuana. It was in one of your books." Uh-oh. They found my stash, so cunningly concealed in a copy of The Hardy Boys and The Disappearing Floor. "Get home right now." I jumped in the car and drove back. I pulled into the driveway and saw a black, unmarked car approaching from around the corner. My heart fell out of my ass. The cops handcuffed me and walked me to the car while I protested my innocence. "What are you doing? Why are you arresting me?" Ah, it never rains, but it pours. My dad had come home early that day because it was his birthday. "Gee, Dad, happy birthday. I just want to make sure we're all here to..." You couldn't put that in a movie. Action. Have the dad drive up while you're being carted off to jail. It got in the paper. The shame. The Italian guilt. "Dad, is there a file in your birthday cake I can borrow?" We were taken down to the police station. They'd popped a bunch of us, most of the kids in my class. We were giving them the finger through the two-way mirror. I'm sitting handcuffed to a bar when this fucking guy who had been smoking pot with us walks in flashing his badge. Deputy Sheriff. The narc was very fucking pleased with himself. I was still playing the injured party. "How could you have betrayed us like that, you ceramic fuck?" I shouted at him. "You set us up." "They're gonna throw the book at you, kid," he said as he walked away. Well, not the book, but maybe a couple of chapters. The narc who busted us was on a vendetta. His brother had died of an OD, and we were the unfortunate victims of his moral crusade. At the hearing, I asked if I could speak to the judge privately. I'd seen enough Perry Mason episodes to know about consultations in the judge's chambers, and once you're in there, you can tell him whatever the fuck you like. I told the judge that this guy, this narc, not me, was the criminal. He'd infiltrated our ceramics class and turned us onto grass, and then busted us for doing it. I said I'd never heard of grass before this, never once tried it. "He was handing out joints, I swear, telling us this was the latest turn-on. I'm Italian, Your Honor." Conveniently, so was the judge. "And I've always lived by my parents' moral code, by the sacred beliefs of the Catholic Church." Ferris Bueller had nothing on me. I got a reprimand and was put on probation. You pay, that's how the system works. The good news is that the 4 misdemeanors I received put a YO, youthful offender, on my draft card, so no fucking Vietnam for me. The bad news is, we'll get to that in an upcoming chapter. I wouldn't have gone to Nam anyway. I was against it. My whole life's been like that. Of course, I also got kicked out of Roosevelt High, but they let me be the guitar player and the music man at the end of the year. Yeah, there was trouble in River City. The trouble was me. Right before the performance, somebody set off an M80 in the bathroom. It was at the end of the year. Everyone was about to graduate, and had all these unfortunate things not befallen me, I would have graduated too. I was devastated. As a memento, I went off with the bass drum that I played in the marching band. That drum came back to life with a haunting vengeance at the end of Living on the Edge. I got sent to Jose Quintano's school for young professionals. 156th West 56th Street. It was a school for a bunch of professional brats and movie stars kids. There were actors, dancers, the girl who played Annie on Broadway, that kind of thing. But it was way more fun than Roosevelt High. Everyone there had this